I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet and Liars Club memoirist Mary Carr, who tells us in Volume 3, Lit, about the three things that lit her in early midlife: spiritual practice, Jack Daniels, and literature. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. Mary Carr gives me three more reasons here to marvel at her. One, the literary company she keeps, that is her writing group, from St. Augustine to John Milton to David Foster Wallace. Second, there's her electric connection with reckless high school kids, particularly girls who want to be Odysseus, to leave home so as to get home. And third is her slightly mysterious wisdom about memoirs, that you have to get over yourself to write well about yourself. We talked in her hotel room on tour in Boston. Mary Carr, it's wonderful to see you again.
Wonderful to be on this side of the grass.
For all your fame as a memoirist, I still think of you as a poet, and I'd love you to just give us a taste of your own work again.
I still think of myself as a poet. This is a poem for my son. The Lit begins with a prologue addressed to my son, and to some extent, the book is an apologia or an explanation for some of the rough years in his earlier life. So this poem is about that age when you watch your kid drive away in the car, and you think, you know, if I saw a giraffe driving my car, I would feel more confident that the car was okay and the giraffe was okay. So this is about that age when he's 16. It's called A Blessing for My 16-Year Son. I have this son who assembled inside me during Hurricane Gloria. In a flash, he appeared in a tiny blaze. Outside, pines toppled. Phone lines snapped and hissed like cobras. Inside, he was a raw pearl, microscopic, luminous. Look at the muscled obelisk of him now, pawing through the icebox for more grapes. 16 years and not a bone broken, not a single stitch. By his age, I was marked more ways and small. He's a slouching 6'3", with implausible blue eyes, which settle on the pages of Emerson's Self-Reliance with profound belligerence. A girl with a navel ring could make his cell phone go buzz. Or an afroed boy leaning on a mop at Taco Bell. Creatures strange to me as dragons or eels. Balanced on a kitchen stool, each gives counsel arcane as any oracles. Rodney claims school is harshing my mellow. Case longs to date a tattooed girl because he wants a woman willing to do stuff she'll regret. They've come to lead my son into his broadening spiral. Someday soon, the tether will snap. I birthed my own mom into oblivion. The night my son smashed the car fender, then rode home in the rain-streaked cop car, he asked, "Did you and Dad screw up this much?" He'd let me tuck him in. My grandmother's wedding quilt from 1912 drawn to his goateed chin. "Don't blame us," I said. "You're your own idiot now." At which he grinned. The cop said the girl in the crimped Chevy took it hard. He'd found my son awkwardly holding her in the canted headlights, where he draped his own coat over her shaking shoulders. "My fault," he'd confessed right off. "Nice kid," said the cop. The end, by Mary Carr. What's the matter?
Nothing. I'm thinking of this muscled obelisk.
Muscled obelisk of himself. He's a big, hairy-legged slab of boy. Or young man now. He's 23.
I'm thinking of it in terms of your memoir, but I'm also thinking, has he had it rough enough to be your child?
Oh, you know, he once said to me when he was a kid, "We need to move from Syracuse." I think he was, you know, we'd been to New York, and he'd been to Steve Martin's apartment, right? He'd been looking at the art, you know, the Francis Bacon and the Roy Lichtenstein, and he's saying, "You know, we need a place like this." And I'm like, "You know, you need a job, you know." And then we get back to Syracuse. He says, "We can't keep living in Syracuse." I said, "Why not?" He was maybe 9. He said, "Because if we keep living in Syracuse, I'll never have anything to write about when I grow up. It'll be too normal." So, yeah, normal is exotic for me. So,
I'm thrilled. I wanted you to sort of start as a poet as a way of talking about this community of the word that runs through the new memoir, Lit. It's the thing that leaps at me above all, this network of writers, including St. Augustine, including Milos, including Milton, including your friends Thomas Lux and our friend Franz Wright. I'm thinking it's the happiest place for a human being to be.
It's the cathedral, you know. I mean, I was totally without any kind of faith, or I didn't have a mystical bone in my body when growing up. I thought God was like the Easter Bunny. I was probably in the fourth grade before I realized people were really serious, that they believed all this stuff. But I believed in the Church of Poetry. I believed that that it was Eucharistic, and that when we took
What does that mean?
Eucharistic, it's like communion. It's like the Eucharist, that when you take somebody's words into your body, it's like you take their passion, their suffering into yourself, and you're changed by it. You know, Shelley would say that the feeling humanizes you more. But you become, in Cavafy's phrase, you know, a citizen of the city of ideas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was a very lonely, strange little girl in this backwater, you know, kind of I would... You know, I had a crush on J. Alfred Prufrock. I mean, I was a pitiful little thing. You know, who, I mean, God, I mean, of all the people. And the other girls were ogling the lifeguard at the town pool, and I was thinking, I was saying indeed, you know, to try to sound British. So I was a little misfit. And, yeah, getting to read these writers, poets mostly, it was majestic. It was magnificent. You could... And the great thing about poetry is it's so portable, and you can have the entire artistic experience in one sitting, in one mouthful, in one moment. You can download the whole thing into your own head and have every inch of the artwork, you know, nothing, no bits forgotten or left off or condensed, you know.
Do you remember the ones who said, you can join this club, you're okay?
You mean other poets?
Yeah, or poems, maybe.
Oh, I mean, I just always knew I had to do it. It never occurred to me I could do it. Hmm. In some ways, I never thought I could do it. You know, I always just felt like I felt compelled. Hmm. You know, if you look at little journals of mine, I write in longhand. This page of this journal that I've mentioned before is actually going to run in the Paris Review interview they just did, where I say when I grow up, I'll write half poetry and half autobiography. And I say, you know, I'm not a very good, big success as a little girl. When I grow up, I will probably be a mess. Isn't that just the saddest? It's so sad. Ugh.
But I want to come back to this. I want to come back to your network. But I also am drawn to Lit, this memoir, as the story of the time in which you were getting ready to write Liars Club. How little we knew.
One reason I wanted to write Lit is that people read The Liars Club in Cherry. And, you know, I would show up on the Liars Club tour, and people thought they were going to find, you know, Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird, or, you know, Huck Finn. Or they thought they were going to see this scrappy, you know, little 10-year-old girl. Scrappy, by the way, is a – and sassy, those are, you know, synonyms for short. It's just another way of saying you're a short person. So – And then with Cherry, you know, I'm writing about this drug-sodden adolescence, but people actually thought that there was something innate in me that permitted me to just walk out of that environment and go, you know, zippity-doo-dah down literary line. And I wanted to connect the dots between, you know, the inferno and the paradiso, between between the wound and the healing, sort of.
Mm. I met you on tour with the Liars Club, and little knew that there you'd been in this neighborhood, so to speak, going through hell, in a sense, on the way to being able to write it.
Right. I know. I mean, it should have been, you know, I met this great guy. I married this Harvard-educated.
No, it should have been what you...
Should have been my dream deal. He could quote more Shakespeare. I was in this community of writers and all of that. And you would have thought, you know, but, you know, my mother was a shadow stitched to my feet. I just couldn't outrun her. And you find, I mean, all parents to some extent find themselves at horrible moments morphing into their own parents, you know, saying, because I said so, you're just smacking your forehead. But for me to feel myself, you know, it's like I said in a recent interview, it's like you're raised by wolves and you wake up one night and you're running across a moonlit field, you know, with blood on your muzzle and a ruff of fur around your neck. They're going, oh, my God, you know, I've become her. You know, I was I'm the alcoholic mom yelling at my toddler in the grocery store, you know, and of course, I wasn't my mother. I remember saying that to my sister at the time, saying, you know, I'm afraid I'm turning into mother, and she burst out laughing. She said, you're nothing like mother. I said, why? I mean, I'm an artist. I'm, you know, complicated. I like a drink. She said, well, you pay your taxes. You have, like, three jobs. You know, you're nothing like mother. You know, she's, like, completely capricious. You woke up in a new world every day.
Part of what I read here is kind of an instruction manual for fathers of girls, and now, like me, grandfathers of girls, who need to know that girls, too, are adventurous, reckless, ambitious,
right,
scrappy,
you know, that's funny.
Lusty,
you said that. I did feel like, you know, there are all these great, you know, well, the Roman de la Roche, and there's quest literature. There's all this great, you know, the guy sets off, you know, on the horse and goes off to war and pushes his father down. And for a girl to push her mother down is unfeminine. You can't reject your childhood and your home because it's not feminine to do that. And you're not supposed to go on a quest. You're supposed to stay home and wait for you're supposed to be Penelope, not Odysseus. So anyway, yeah, I thought Odysseus probably had more fun. And so, you know, Lit begins when I climb in a truck with a bunch of surfers and heads to go seek my fortune working in a T-shirt factory in California, you know, cheerfully.
And then what happens?
Well, I mean, a lot of things happen. I weasel my way into college somehow, which is a miracle, and I weasel my way into graduate school. I meet this, you know, 6-foot-5-inch guy who looks like something you win at a raffle, and he can quote more Shakespeare. And my sister says, you know, he should just walk out with his hands up. You know, I was just so in love with him. But he was such a WASP, you know, Harvard, Long Island, horsey, polo-playing family, boarding school. You know, he was like the anti-venom to the snake bite of who I was. And in some ways, all of Boston and Cambridge is, you know, that sort of pumpkin Puritan backbone. You know, like they had this dog, Tiger, and when Tiger 1 died, they got Tiger 2 and then Tiger 3. And they manufactured a universe in which dogs never died. They just didn't die. And I thought, these people have found the solution. They've got it all going on. They can pretend anything is not happening better than most heroin addicts. They can just ignore the obvious, you know, to keep the surface smooth. Plus, they don't steal your televisions like the average heroin addict might. So.
We know the type. Lit gets serious around drinking, around depression, around a search for, of all things, God.
Around baby Jesus.
Yeah.
Around literature, around poetry, you know, around baby Jesus. Yeah, it's about all the ways I was lit. You know, I was lit by poetry. I was lit by Jack Daniels. You know, I was lit by a spiritual practice. I was the last person I thought would ever have. I was just lifelong atheist, had no interest, didn't seek it, didn't want it. But I kept driving into stuff, you know, had more molecular density than I have.
In the context of all sorts of conversations we've had with poets, what leads to what in this search that you've recounted, the introspection, the distillation, the depression, the personal experience, the entry of God into the book as a question?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get there?
Well, despair. I mean, I think no one ever turns to very. I mean, saints and people turn to God from virtue, but I was saying last night, you know, in D.C. where I gave a reading. You know, I thought all the things I thought protected me were in fact killing me. Mm-hmm. Like I thought I didn't want to quit drinking. I didn't quit drinking because I felt like quitting drinking. I mean, an alcoholic doesn't wake up in the morning and think, "Gee, I think I'll not drink today." The drinking felt like it protected me. It was a relief. It had been my friend, and then it kind of turned on me. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't imagine living without it. I felt compelled to drink. And I had this baby, you know, that I knew I would turn into my mother if I continued to drink. I couldn't do it. I started. Somebody suggested I couldn't get sober. I just couldn't. I kept trying. This goes on for a couple of years. I'm getting worse and worse. And finally, somebody suggested I try praying on my knees morning and night, which I did. And it just seemed like hypnosis. Like I thought, I didn't drink. I did this today. It was sort of like if you carried a rabbit's foot in your pocket and you hit a home run, you know, you carry it the next day. I mean, it seemed like a small thing to do, right?
Mary, you're the memoirist who, above all, discovers that you have to get over yourself.
I think if you're working on a memoir and your main enemy isn't, your main antagonist isn't some aspect of yourself, then you're probably in the wrong business. You probably ought to be writing fiction or something else because, you know, it's not that my mother tried to kill me with a butcher knife. My mother tried to kill me with a butcher knife one night of my life, and then she didn't anymore, and she did a lot of other things. So why should that event define me? Well, obviously, you know, trauma affects people this way. It's a human response I was traumatized, obviously, and I'm sure I had post-traumatic stress and chronic depression and, you know, all kinds of ailments. But, you know, as my mother once told me, you know, I might be responsible for 90% of your problems. My mother got sober at 62, which was a great gift to me. And I remember her saying, you know, I might be responsible for 90% of your problems. You're 100% responsible for the solution. And that's the truth. I mean, you know, we're all done evil to when we all suffer. I mean, it's the Buddhist, right? The first noble truth that life is suffering. And it's also true that the people you love the most in the world will disappoint you the most cruelly. And they, you know, that grief and that pain and that hurt is the bill that comes due for the gift of having loved somebody, you know. You know, my son told me, and I think this is in the book. I don't remember what's in there. My son, who actually, the reason I wound up going to church, he came to him one morning. He came to me one morning and said, I want to go to church. And I said, why? And he said, to see if God's there. Which was really like the only sentence he could have said that would have gotten me to go there. And so we did this thing called Gadarama, where we went to all these different churches and masses and whatnot. And I would not, anyway, eventually we wound up Catholic. But a very reluctant kind of Catholic for me. It was all metaphorical. And I remember he was about he was 7 or 8, I guess, when he was baptized. And I was over 40. And I remember him looking at the crucifix after Mass one day, and he was running around with his friends, and I said, you know, I just don't like this. I don't want some guy, Nick Flynn has a poem, you know, I don't want some guy ripping open his shirt saying, look what I did for you. You know, I don't need that kind of grief. Why this? You know, why do you have to be redeemed this way? And Deb, who'd been showed Pulp Fiction by my mother when he was a child, thinking he wanted to see it, he had heard about it, he said, Mom, we wouldn't pay attention to something nice. We wouldn't pay attention to, like, the Garden of Eden. No one would pay attention to that. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, let's say you just had to say jump rope rhymes or something, and then you were redeemed. No one would pay any. He said, you know, we got baptized, and all our sins were washed away. And that's a really big thing, if you think about that, that everything bad you ever did is gone, and you have this clean start in the world, and no one pays any attention to that. But if you're crucified, hey, that's like, and I'm like, yeah, it's like the, you know, when the Romans, you know, would feed the Christians to the lions. So people are amused by this kind of gore. This draws us. You know, the Protestants are too polite for that. They're too nice, you know, and the Catholics are, yeah, I like the carnality of the church. I think that's true.
Mary Carr, nothing fascinates me more than the grip of your writing on young people, young girls especially, but all of them. I've seen you on your Facebook page, the kids, boys and girls, of Beaver Country Day School.
Beaver Country Day School.
Let's hear it for the Beavers.
Let me tell you, my sister calls me this morning. I'm in D.C. in the airport. She says, if you don't go to Beaver Country Day School, I'm not your sister anymore. I said, what are you talking about? I whip out my computer. These kids have made this video with a beaver They've got a literary club called the Liars Club, boys and girls, and they've got this Beaver, and they are holding up signs with 10 reasons why I should come to Beaver Country Day School while I'm in Boston. And I've got a schedule that looks like, looks like Obama's. I mean, it's just from thing to thing to thing to thing. I'm in a different city every day until Thanksgiving. And I instantly have my publicist get in touch with the school, and I'm going to go to Beaver Country Day School tomorrow at 7:30.
And they're there on a video saying, "We love you, Mary Carr.
We want to write memoirs like yours. And we want you to come to Beaver Country Day School."
What's the secret? And I don't want, I mean, let's spell it out.
Secret is just obviously my sheer genius. I mean, obviously, they recognized
it. Charm and your beauty, too.
It's my charm and my beauty. But no, I think, and this is what I love about books, and this is what I loved about books. You know, I love the story, obviously, of Joyce, what's her name, going to see Salinger, right? When she was
Maynard.
Joyce Maynard going to see Salinger, although it becomes a more grisly story. But I remember reading that and thinking, I could meet J.D. Salinger when I was in high school. And it was like meeting, it was like, you know, seeing a saint's bone or something. You know, you just can't, what could be more holy than meeting Salinger? And so I might not sell a million books. I mean, this might not be eat, pray, make money or whatever. But it, but the truth is, the people who read me and like my books feel a deep connection to me. They might not, it might not be as broad as another book, but they feel a deep connection to me and I to them, and they write me things and tell me things about their lives. You know, people write me from prison. People write me from their deathbeds. People send me Xerox photographs of their parents who did terrible things to them and explain what those things were and come to my readings and talk about their therapist. And it's to me a very moving thing. It's, first off, it's a relief when you're being an employee of your former self by going on the road talking about a book you wrote that you forgot about a year ago. But the truth is, you know, I cried. I cried when I saw those kids, you know, with their T-shirts, you know, and they're writing their memoirs. And they have stories to tell. And for all the, when people say, why is memoir enjoying this sort of surge of interest, when it really is a kind of a lesser art than fiction, it's no question. It's more limited. It's structurally less complicated. But you have people, the reader is guaranteed a writer who is intensely emotionally invested in the story. It's a story, nothing you write. And Jeffrey Wolfe and Tobias Wolfe, who both write fiction and memoir, have, I remember Jeffrey saying to me, nothing you ever write will ever have higher emotional stakes. And so for a reader, I think, to get in this age of this very cool, slick metafiction with this very bejeweled intellectual surface, to get guaranteed a book that's written where someone really gives a rat's ass, you know, how you feel about the book and how the story is told, that's not nothing. I think that's why memoir is being read right now. So I've already won the book lottery with this book. If I never, if I don't sell another book, then to the ones I sell to the Beaver Country Day School. And I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go to the damn Beaver Country Day School until they have to go to math class second period.
I want to stick with those kids. And I know some of them. One of them told me, look, Mary Carr has done something for the girls. She's reminded us that girls, too, will have casual sex. They may do drugs in their teens. And they will find their minds. They will wake up smart, too.
Yeah. And they'll also, you know, they'll be foolish about boys, and they'll write a guy's name on their notebooks over and over. And they'll also go on great adventures and slaughter monsters and go from island to island. And like Odysseus, leave home, come home by leaving home. They will become themselves. They will come into themselves. They will come and come to.
What are you going to tell those kids tomorrow about how to start their own memoirs?
Vis-a-vis the memoir, Tobias Wolfe sent me a great letter saying, take no care for your dignity, you know. And to some extent, again, it's that thing, if you're writing because someone did something to you, you know, you're fighting the wrong dragon. You know, a really great memoir has some aspect of self or personal history as the antagonist. It's not in Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life. It's not, stepfather, you know, beat the crap out of him. But it's an interesting book because in a way it's a book in which Toby is trying on different costumes. The book begins, he says, when I was a kid and my mother was divorced, she gets her to buy him an Indian costume when they're driving across the desert. In a way, throughout the book, Toby puts on one male costume after another, and he stands on the street and watches men come down the street and pretends that they're his father. And it's about trying to be a man. He gets a Boy Scout uniform that's too big, and he tries to fake his way into prep school, and he borrows this tweed coat that made him sweat and wore in July. And he's got basketball shoes, and he wears his street shoes on the basketball court and everything. And while his stepfather's beating the crap out of him, he's kind of trying on that form of masculinity to see if that's the way he's going to become a man. I mean, it's not my mother that's the problem. It's not my love for my mother that's the problem. It's the insidious ways that I inherited some of her less healthy habits as a ways of just bad coping skills, you know.
Mary Carr, thank you for extending the community of the word and the writers and the poets and the memoirists to include us. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Mary Carr. Thanks to our Brown University interns, Ben Mandelkern, and especially Hannah Olson, for feeling all that Mary Carr rapture. Share what Mary Carr and the memoir trip have meant to you at our website, radioopensource.org. And thank you for joining the conversation. I'm Christopher Lydon.